approach the end of our year here at Nexus, I want to remind you, if you in any way find our work and ministry here at Nexus meaningful, if you would consider an end-of-year donation. We want to make sure we end our year in the positive, of course, and so just want to remind you that pre-authorized giving and cash check in the support invest box is always welcome. And I wanted to remind you of that this morning because giving's been on my mind. A few weeks ago, I guess it was November, our family, Kristen and I and the kids, we had a little meeting in the kitchen about ways that we could maybe do a little extra this December, ways we could give a little bit more. And started thinking through some ways we could give. And Kristen, of course, has worked with the YWCA in Cambridge for a long time. And she's like, you know what? I've got this idea. The YWCA, they've got this program where they support single mothers. And single mothers oftentimes at Christmas don't get things for Christmas. And so the YWCA creates their sort of dream Christmas list. And you can sort of take one and buy those gifts for the mother. And we thought, you know what, that sounds like a great idea. We could do that as a family together. It'll be wonderful. We can go to the mall together, do the shopping list. It'll be great for the kids. And we thought it'd be great because they would be involved in it, and it's something we could do together. Now, we should have seen the folly of this perhaps beforehand. I mean, first of all, taking kids shopping and telling them this is not about them seems a little bit foolhardy. Zoe, though, she was completely on board, very excited. Huxley thought it sounded boring. But I swear I heard Evie mutter something like, silly parents think it's not going to be about us. We'll see about that. And then the second reason this was a bad idea is because Kristen and I, we shop in very different ways. And I don't like shopping with her. She doesn't like shopping with me. But we decided we'd go ahead with this, and it started to go downhill rather quickly because we got on the LRT, we went to Fairview Mall, and one of the things on the list was new bed sheets. And so we started looking around for bed sheets, and Kristen found some for $20. She's like, oh, what a great deal. Let's get the bed sheets. And I took a look at them. I said, I'm sorry, not so fast. That only has a 200 thread count. I can't be party to buying somebody's bed sheets that have a 200 thread count. I mean, it's got to be 800 minimum, maybe even 1,000, right? You got to get up there. And so Kristen and I are disagreeing right away. She's cheap. I like to quality. And so we're sort of disagreeing on things to buy, and so it's not going well. And the kids, of course, they're getting restless. They're getting frustrated. And Evie, she can't say the words, what about? She says, woof about. And everywhere she went, woof about you get me that, and woof about you get me this, and Chris and I can't agree on what to buy, and so we're not getting anywhere with the shopping list. The kids are melting down. They start crying. I'm like, this isn't about you. This is about joyfully giving to others. And I'm getting upset, and Kristen realized I needed a timeout. And she said, listen, there's a bathrobe on the list. You go on your own. Get a bathrobe. I'll take the kids. I'll get the rest. Fine. So I took off, found the bathrobe section, and started looking and touching these different bathrobes. And right as I'm feeling the different textures of the bathrobes, Frank Sinatra's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas comes on. Him crooning away, have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. And I'm feeling these bathrobes. And I'm listening to Frank Sinatra. And in that moment, a memory came back to me that I had forgotten. It was a Christmas, I believe, last Christmas before any of my siblings and our partners had kids, and I had received a bathrobe. And my mind was taken back to this Christmas morning with the family, and I'm sitting there in my bathrobe, and I could picture it all. I remember my brother Troy got me a gift, and he never got me gifts, so this sort of stuck out to me. He handed me a package, and it was a David Sedaris book, one of my favorite authors. And I'm sitting there in the mall, flustered, remembering this Christmas moment. And I start to smile. And my heart is warm because in that moment I missed it. I missed those days. And my heart warmed. And I'm smiling and I pick a bathrobe. And I head back to Kristen and the kids feeling reoriented, smiling on my face. This is beautiful. And get back to Kristen. I said, I just had a lovely memory. She said, I don't care. The kids are melting down. We have to retreat. It's basically mutinous right now. And so we quickly bought our things. Kids tried to stuff some food in their mouths, got back on the LRT, headed home. And that moment vanished. But for this brief moment, it was like I had been transported to the past. And I missed it. Nostalgia. You know, it catches us sometimes in the most peculiar of moments. And no matter who we are, no matter how old, no matter how young, all of us experience nostalgia. In fact, a cover story in the New York Times a few years back said this: most people report experiencing nostalgia at least once a week, and nearly half of people experience it 3 or 4 times a week. What makes people nostalgic? Nostalgia has a wide range of triggers, right? It can catch you in the most unexpected moments. It could be thoughts about the past or particular places or objects. It can be smells. It can be touch. It can be music, of course, even the weather. But research shows that one of the most common triggers of nostalgia is actually feeling lonely, disconnected. Which would make complete sense of my moment in the mall. Is there any place more soul-sucking than the mall? Not getting along with my kids, perhaps feeling lonely, this moment came over me. But there's something universal about nostalgia. We all experience it. And yet, when it comes to nostalgia, we find ourselves in a very unique time in history. You see, humans have always felt nostalgic, but the age of modernity has cranked up the frequency and intensity of our nostalgia. We are experiencing nostalgia today more frequently and intensely than ever. Why? I mean, consider that while humans throughout history have experienced it, the age of modernity has meant that we're at a very different place. Most people, even just 200 years ago, they lived basically and traveled no farther than one day's walk from where they were born. And time was experienced as mostly seasons and cycles, and when there's little movement or change in your life, nostalgia is more existential than something we can perhaps experience or consume regularly. But modernity changed all that because we travel far and wide now. In fact, with the pace of our lives, it's just getting cranked up. But the origin of the word nostalgia is really interesting and sort of comical to me. It was first coined in the year 1688, right when the masses of the world could travel with sort of more in greater ease. And the story of how we came to it is interesting. It was coined by a Swiss doctor named Johannes Hofer, and it literally means longing to return home. And it was applied to a group of Swiss mercenaries who had been employed by the French army. And while traveling for combat, these Swiss soldiers, they came to the doctor. They needed help because they were experiencing this odd sensation, this odd longing to return to their Alpine villages. And Dr. Hofer's notes on this mysterious illness are rather comical. He believed nostalgia was responsible for exhausting vital spirits, nausea, loss of appetite, cardiac arrest, and even suicide. He also reported that these people heard voices and saw ghosts. And, of course, he had to come up with a remedy. So, for the condition, he prescribed the usual cures of the day, opium and leeches. Imagine that, right? Christmas, you're feeling all nostalgic. Doctor says, have some opium and some leeches. Get really high with some leeches on you. I mean, it just sounds like a recipe for a really bad trip, right? I'm so high, I feel great. Why are leeches all over my body? And that's the first time we sort of see the word nostalgia, but as modernity has gained steam. By 1800, nostalgia was no longer restricted to homesick soldiers. It was affecting multitudes of Europeans on the move. And it's only gained steam since then. In fact, nostalgia today is so rampant, it has become so rampant, nostalgia no longer is something we feel, it's something we consume. And some would say in the process, nostalgia is beginning to consume us. I mean, consider our entertainment. Just working on the sermon this week, it was feeling nostalgic. I watched Lord of the Rings Friday night. Had to return to the past a little bit there. My, oh my, it's such a journey going into Middle-earth, revisiting the Shire, all the things associated with that. But our entertainment and artistic culture are full of nostalgia. Our most viewed films revolve around characters that were created a generation or multiple generations ago. Superheroes, supervillains, secret agents, space adventures. Disney has relaunched all of their classics in CGI. Why? Because we lap that stuff up. And on television, not only are shows from the 90s making reappearances and coming back, but a lot of the shows that we watch are situated in the past. Mad Men, Downton Abbey, even stuff like Game of Thrones. Music-wise, if you look at Billboard's top grossing tours of the past 5 to 10 years, they're almost all heritage acts. Elton John, Guns N' Roses, Bruce Springsteen, U2, Pink Floyd, The Eagles. In fact, what's becoming standard these days is what? Artists touring albums they released 25 years ago. It's the same with technology. Our technology, in many ways, has become a manufacturer of nostalgia. Mohsen Hammett describes the nostalgic lure of technology today. He says this, on our dominant social networks, we're pulled out of the present moment to constantly shape and examine and interact with carefully curated past. Through technology, the past is made real to us in a way it never has been before. I can see myself 5 seconds ago, my first girlfriend 5 hours ago, my first child 5 months ago, my first dog 5 years ago, my first smile in my mother's arm 5 decades ago. They can sift endlessly through these archives of past moments, mesmerizing myself as the world outside my screen goes unnoticed for increasingly long interludes. I mean, to be honest, the only great thing about Facebook these days is the memories they show you, it feels like. And then there's politics. And notice how it's reflected in our politics. I mean, consider the potent force of it. Pete Hamill says this, the most powerful force in American politics is not anger, it's nostalgia. Nostalgia manifests itself in our political divisions, and it goes far beyond just American politics. Consider the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. They were fueled by what? A thirst to return to the imagined glories of the early years of Islam. The Brexit campaign, a thirst to return to the glory days of pre-EU Britain. Donald Trump won his presidency on nostalgia, make America great again. And when we look further around the world, the same thing's happening. Similar language, return to a world before colonization. Countries like Russia, China, India, the desire to return to imagined past greatness before invaders, before influencers ruined utopias of the past. It is fascinating to me, all of these rapid changes that we're experiencing are increasing our nostalgic longings. And I'm curious, what are we to do with nostalgia, this thing we all experience, this human phenomenon? How are we supposed to think about it? How should we indulge in it? Well, I want to present you with the perils and I think the promise of nostalgia. I'll go to the perils first. What I love about the wisdom tradition in Scripture is it just sort of leaves you hanging. It leaves like these wisdom nuggets out there with no explanation. And in Ecclesiastes 7, we find this isolated proverbial saying. It's just this nugget of wisdom, just hanging there. What it says is this, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it's not wise to ask such questions. And then that's it. You're like, really? Why is it not wise to ask such questions? What isn't good about it? We're just left. That's wisdom, apparently. We're sort of left to guess, so I'm going to guess. Looking to the past, I think nostalgia can be perilous because it tempts us to believe in a fictionalized past. What do I mean by that? You know, it's very interesting. I want to do a series sometime on memory. because we're learning some very interesting things about memories these days, and one of the things we're learning is that the way we think about our past, the past, is always an idealized version of something we want it to be, not what we know as reality. And so the way we remember is constantly distorted, not by the actuality of its events. Alan Hirsch says this: nostalgia is a longing for a sanitized impression of the past, what in psychoanalysis is referred to as a screen memory, not a true recreation of the past, but rather a combination of many different memories, all integrated together, and in the process, all negative emotions filtered out. My family is planning a trip together, whole Watson family, next summer. So my brothers and I were chatting about our childhood trips going up, and we can't remember many of them, actually. We were talking about, there was the time we went to Disney World, remember that one. There's the time we went to Nashville. And I was saying to them, like, my goodness, that was such a fun trip. All of us together, it was great. And I remember my brother Scott is like, are you kidding me? I said, what are you talking about? He's like, that was an awful trip. What do you mean? He's like, we drove to Nashville, which is a 12-hour ride in a 1988 Chrysler New Yorker. There's six of us. That car can fit five. I was like, huh, I don't remember it being that uncomfortable. He's like, well, do you remember this? That our car broke down in Ohio, and we had to spend the day playing in a mechanic's back parking lot an entire day while Dad got the car fixed? I'm like, strange, I don't remember that. And then he's like, and then the purpose of the trip, Brad, was that our parents thought it would be a fun idea to take us four boys to a quartet convention. Yeah. Do you know what quartets are? There's four people singing in harmony, and this was a three-day convention, 9 a.m. till 9 p.m., quartets on stage, and we were there for all of it. Every day, 9 a.m. showed up, 9 p.m. left. It's like what were our parents thinking, Brad? Taking four kids to a quartet convention, it was awful. I was like, but didn't the hotel have a pool? I remember a pool. My brother's like, yeah, it had a pool, but that trip was awful. And it's weird because the way I remember things is not quite that way, but the reality of it is it wasn't exactly a family trip to write home about. Lauren Martin describes the danger of nostalgia succinctly here. What we yearn for from the past is not reality. It's been scrubbed clean and filtered. And so nostalgia can reduce us into retreating into this romanticized past where the bad and the boring bits of the past fade from our memory more quickly than our peak experiences. The Romans, they had a phrase for the phenomenon. I'm going to mess it up. Psychologists call it rosy retrospection. In Latin, it's memoria praetorum bonorum. The past is always well remembered. Nostalgia can tempt us to believe in a utopia that never existed. Our glory days were probably not as glorious as we remember them. Todd Bowman sent me this quote. It reminded me of the song Andy Bernhard said, I wish there was a way to know you're in the good old days before they've actually left them. It makes sense. It's comically the point. You don't know when you're in your glory days, and by the time it's passed, your reflections on them are probably fictionalized. Bad and boring parts scrubbed out. And so nostalgia can tempt us to get hung up on the past, end up believing in glory days that didn't really exist at all, or were not as glorious as we thought they were, at least. And so to fixate or long on a fictional past, be that as an individual, as a collective, it's dangerous. We're seeing those dangers play out today around the world. But it's not like we're going to stop being nostalgic creatures. It's part of our makeup. It's what we do. So what do we do with this? Is there a way to redeem nostalgia? This, of course, brings us to Advent, the season we are in leading up to Christmas. Advent is, of course, a season of longing, of waiting, of expectation, which in some ways sounds quite similar to me to nostalgia. Within the Psalms of Scripture, there are a small group of Psalms known as the Exilic Psalms. There's about 10 or 12 of them people consider to be songs written from exile or from the point of view of exile. And within these psalms, we're given songs of nostalgia, songs of longing, songs about the good old days. Psalm 137 is, of course, a classical example of this. The way they employ nostalgia is fascinating here. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars, we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy, Jerusalem, the glorious past, the best of times, we're so sad it's over. We want to go back home. We want to return to the golden days. And these psalms are songs of nostalgia. But what really intrigues me is when Jesus shows up on the scene, he sort of plays with this. And we got to sort of remember again that for these people, when they got out of exile, the very first thing they did was what? We got to rebuild the temple. The temple had been destroyed. They had been taken to exile when they got out. Rebuild it. We must rebuild the temple, the glorious temple. And when Jesus shows up, this is exactly what they've done. But then, Jesus marches into the temple, and he clears it out. He stops it from operating, shuts it down. As you can imagine, people are not happy. What gives you the right to shut down this place? This is our glory. So it says in John 2, the Jews then respond to him, what sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. They replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. I think we have to understand the context, how important this building was to them, to understand the sort of how scandalous this was. I mean, consider this building. When it was destroyed, Twin Towers on September 11th, it was a foregone conclusion, right? We're going to rebuild this thing. And it's going to be a reminder. It's going to be a momentous building that is about freedom. So we're going to rebuild it. I mean, imagine someone showing up and saying, stop, what's happening there? That's not what we're really looking for. In fact, if it's destroyed again, I could rebuild it in 3 days. You'd be like, this person is off their rocker. Or what about this building? When it burned, however long ago that was, recently, so many people, right? Oh my goodness, we have to rebuild and restore. For a lot of people, this building is about beauty and transcendence. It's about divine encounters, perhaps, and imagine someone saying, no, stop. That's not what you're really looking for. Where you're going to find transcendence is not through this building, but through me. We would think that person was off their rocker. Whatever longing those buildings point to for you, that longing actually points to me. What if Jesus showed up and said that? Like, wow. And this is what Jesus is doing in this temple scene. He's showing up and saying, whatever this building represents to you, whatever it points to for you, know that your longing, whatever's contained in that building for you, it's actually pointing to me and what I'm doing in the world. And of course, the temple for these people represented God's presence in the world. It was a place where heaven and earth came together. It was where the world was right. And I believe what Jesus is doing here is pointing them towards where their nostalgia actually points. Their nostalgia was rooted in what those things symbolized, a world at right, a world as it should be, the safety and security of home, being at peace with God, with each other, with ourselves, Their true nostalgic longing wasn't about a building or a location or a city. It was something much deeper. True longing of nostalgia is for a world as it should be. Safety and security of home, peace with God, each other, and ourselves. How many of you played tabletop hockey growing up? Pretty fun, eh? I haven't played on one of these in a long, long time, but I have fond memories of tabletop hockey and losing the puck. But imagine somebody was like, this is hockey. This right here, that's what I want. That's hockey. We would say, you're out of your mind. This but points to a greater reality. Without real hockey, this is essentially meaningless. This little game is evidence and points to something far greater. A true world of hockey. Or my kids and wife think I'm crazy, but I love fried bologna. I love fried bologna. Still curious why it isn't pronounced bologna. But bologna. I grew up with bologna, and my mother had a recipe. I'm going to share it with you. This is a treat. You get yourself some bologna, you start frying it up in a frying pan, and at the same time, you take a cup of mustard and a cup of brown sugar, and you mix them together. And then you put it in a saucepan, and you heat it up not too quick. You don't want to burn it. Just get it all simmering. And when your fried bologna's done, you smother it in this mustard brown sugar sauce. Ah, I love it. Oh, it's so good. Oh, you're going to have a treat with that this afternoon. And growing up, this was often a staple. Fried bologna with the sauce and a boiled potato. Boiled, I don't know why, that's how my parents did it. They boiled a potato. That was dinner. Mmm. I love it. And Kristen's like, that is disgusting. Bologna is a vile, vile thing. That much sugar and mustard. The whole thing's gross. And here's the thing. It's a mistake to think that my longing, whenever I smell fried bologna, oh, I love it. But you see, it's not actually about the fried bologna. It's about what that meal points to. And what it pointed to for me when I smell that, when I taste it, it's about home and how I always felt safe at home and accepted at home. Could be myself at home. And so it's about fried bologna, it's about the tabletop hockey, but it's not. It's deeper. It's pointing somewhere, something much deeper. And I think that's how we can learn to understand our own nostalgia. Nostalgia understood properly is not about returning to glory days. It's not about recreating childhood Christmas. It's not about trying to find warm, cozy memories. Those things are simply pointing to something deeper. Nostalgia is a whispered reminder that there is such a thing as the world at right. Like how Michael Chabon sums it up, nostalgia, most truly and most meaningfully, is the emotional experience and feeling, always momentary, always fragile, that overcomes you when some minor vanished beauty of the world is momentarily remembered or restored. And in that, nostalgia doesn't point us backwards, it points us forwards. The longings we feel when we're nostalgic at the root are about wanting the world to be at right, wanting the world to return home to its creator, where it's all redeemed and made new. I know for a lot of people, Christmas can be a lonely time, whether it's because you're single or don't have any family, or maybe even if you're grandparents, right, that reality that maybe Christmas morning is pretty lonely. And there are moments, I don't know what it is about Christmas trees, in the dark, they just sort of spur these feelings within you. And I've had those too, that feeling of loneliness at Christmas. And I think what we can mistake is that feeling we get at Christmas time is about, I wish I could go back and be with my kids again, or I wish I had family to be with right now. But I think the deeper The deeper impulse there is this: the real longing is for loneliness to end in the world. That our longing would be fulfilled, that we would no longer know the experience of loneliness. Or for those of us, maybe you're right in that age. I know I am, right? The kids are at the perfect age, and it's like everything inside me wants to create that perfect moment for them. Perfect Christmas moment. I got a longing for that. I have memories of my own Christmases and want that for them too, but I think the danger is thinking, yeah, if I just set this up right, I'll have a moment of perfection. I think the real longing, the real impulse underneath that is that this would be a world where everyone feels at home. That all of us would belong and feel safe and secure. And those special moments with family are just a glimpse of a bigger reality. Behind our nostalgia is something much larger. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin says this: a sense of the universe, sense of the all, the nostalgia which seizes us when confronted by nature, beauty, music, these seem to be an expectation and awareness of a great presence. Or C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Weight of Glory, speaks of nostalgia this way: the books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust them. It was not in them, it only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire, but if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. Fear not the thing in itself, they are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have not visited. And this is what Advent asks us to wait for the flower, for the tune, for the country to arrive. This is the hope and longing of Advent. The story of God making all things new begins with a little baby in a manger. But the thing we celebrate is not the past. It's not the baby in the manger. It's what it points us toward, to a future where one day all things will be made new. Again, Chabon says this: nostalgia combines the sadness of what we've lost with the joy or satisfaction in trusting that the loss is not complete or final. And I love that. The sadness, or whatever those emotions we're feeling in nostalgia, the sadness accompanied with a trust that what is gone is not lost forever. I'm going to ask the band to come and close us with the song of expectation and waiting, but I would say for us this Christmas season, get nostalgic. Do it. Why not? And some of us, myself included, I could be fairly grumpy and bah humbug. But allow ourselves to become nostalgic. Allow ourselves to be caught up in the magic of that. Do the rituals that make you nostalgic. For me, it's Chinese food Christmas Eve. Maybe for you, it's watching those corny Christmas movies. Singing the songs, eating the food, whatever it is that makes you nostalgic, do it. Have fun. Feel the feels. But the message of Advent is this: those things and the longings they create in you, what they're really pointing towards is the scent of a flower we haven't found. It's the echo of a tune we've not fully heard. It's news from a country we have yet to see. But the message is this: those moments that we remember or feel perfect to us, they're a glimpse. Even if they're just momentary, they're pointing to something. The promise and hope of a world made new. For now, we wait.